morning. It's Friday, November 3rd. Please be sure to vote next Tuesday. Welcome to Electric Politics. I'm George Kenney. How fitting it is to wake up this morning and read in the New York Times that the Bush administration, in its zeal to prove just how bad the Iraqis were, put all sorts of captured Iraqi documents on the web, including instructions, the most detailed publicly available to date, on how to build the bomb. An advanced cookbook for anybody who happens to have enough of the right kind of uranium in the larder. Following complaints and questions by experts and arms control officials, according to the Times, the government shut down the site last night. One wonders how much the tyrant's team really cares about nonproliferation, despite how much they like to talk about it. As with so many other aspects of policy, nonproliferation seems to be, in many ways, a cover for some different agenda. One of the excellent points Gordon Prather makes in a moment. Let me just say first a couple words about the length of this podcast. My philosophy going into these conversations is that I want to understand something about the way people think, about why what's important to them is important. To me, this is just as interesting, or perhaps more so, than the particular details of their opinions. In that light, I prefer to take a somewhat oblique, elliptical approach in my questions, and I'm more than happy to give the guest the lead when there is something that they want to say. I do, nevertheless, understand that some of you will be horrified at the prospect of listening to a conversation that runs for 2 hours and 20 minutes, not counting my intro and exit. As far as I know, it may even be a world record for a podcast. Even before posting it, I've gotten a shocked reaction from one very smart, thoughtful previous guest. But this has happened only once in almost a year. I don't expect it to happen again for a long time, if ever. And having listened through it all for the second time last night while editing, I remain convinced that I had no other way of learning about Gordon's thinking than by listening and letting him talk. At the same time, it does make sense to me that some people have legitimate reasons to prefer shorter shows. Fortunately, there may be a solution. Some conversations, I think, could benefit from being deliberately recorded shorter or edited down. Coincidentally, two I've recently recorded, for different reasons, don't meet my normal standards, despite being interesting, to me at least, but probably would be easier for you, the audience, to take if cut back to half an hour or so, which could be a good way to do in-between shows, and perhaps more of them, as an offset to the regular Friday show. Well, I'll experiment with variations, but for the regular show, I'm sticking to my guns. So, here's a crash course on nuclear proliferation from a fellow who was in the business. Let's listen. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Dr. James Gordon Prather. Dr. Prather's long association with U.S. nuclear weapons programs includes active duty with the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, participation in nuclear weapons tests at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, and as a technical director at Sandia National Laboratory. He was chief scientist for the Army under the Reagan administration. He has served as a policy implementing official for national security technical matters in the Federal Energy Agency, the Energy Research and Development Administration, the Department of Energy, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the Department of the Army. He received his Ph.D. in physics from Utah State University and his B.S. in physics from the University of Oklahoma. He writes frequently on national security issues for antiwar.com and lewrockwell.com. Welcome, Gordon.
Well, thank you.
Good to have you. I'm curious to know a little bit more about your background because on the internet you've got a kind of a basic, very short bio that seems to follow you everywhere. But I was just wondering how is it that you got into bomb design? I know that you were commissioned early on into the Navy, and the Navy, probably prompted by you to a certain extent, decided to put you on a nuclear track. But how did that happen?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was commissioned through the Navy ROTC program at the University of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
and had requested that I be assigned. I'd always intended to go to graduate school after I got out of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I hoped one day maybe I might work at Los Alamos or something like that. Well, at any rate, I had, when everybody got their orders, I didn't get any, and I didn't know why that was, because I'd requested Destroyers East Coast for my first three choices.
Yeah.
Because I'd been, as a midshipman, I'd been on Destroyers East Coast, and I thought that would be a good way to spend my active duty time.
Mm-hmm.
To my surprise, I got orders to the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project. And we in the Navy ROTC unit at the University of Oklahoma had never heard of it, didn't even know what it was.
That's funny.
And it was not until I actually arrived here in Albuquerque, and I'm back in Albuquerque again now, or just outside Albuquerque,
mm-hmm.
that I discovered that that was a name for the Tri-Service Nuclear Weapons Project.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I'd never even heard of it. And it was highly secret in those days. We're
sure.
talking a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got into the nuclear weapons business on the active duty side, and I participated in a number of operational readiness tests in the Western Pacific using the Regulus missile, which was had a nuclear weapon on board, and was at various times. For brief periods of time, on almost every ship in the United States Navy in the Western Pacific that had nuclear weapons.
Wow.
Well, when I got out of the Navy, the best offer I got was from Lawrence Livermore Lab that was interested in my experience up until then.
Mm-hmm.
While there in Livermore, I was in the active reserve and I was in a research unit. And I wasn't in the design part of the nuclear weapons business. I was in the nuclear test business. So it was full-up operational test of devices that I was involved in while I was at Lawrence Livermore. Then I went back to get my Ph.D., and when I got out of there, the best offer I got was from Sandia National Laboratories back here in Albuquerque.
Well, that's logical, yeah.
So what it amounted to is that some person way down in the Department of Bureau of Personnel in the Navy took it upon himself to assign me to the Nuclear Weapons Project, and I was essentially never able to get out of the nuclear weapons business until I went to Washington, D.C.
I want to get to D.C. In just a second. I know you said in one interview I listened to that you'd come to D.C. in 1972, but I'm just curious if I could ask one other question about your experience with tests, because people I know, their parents were observers for some of these. Were you out in the Pacific when they were watching some of these things being these tests above land? Or
I was scheduled to be. I was in graduate school at the time, but I worked summers at first Lawrence Livermore Lab and then at EG&G, which was, at that time, a very strong participant in our nuclear weapons test program.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, EG&G ran Nevada Test Site for then the Atomic Energy Commission, now it's Department of Energy.
Right.
So, but no, I atmospheric test, I only was in the data reduction end of it. You know, I wasn't actually sent out into the Pacific as a graduate student to participate in the test.
Well, you're lucky. You probably still have your thyroid gland then.
No, well, well, that's another subject entirely. But
by
and large, the effects of the accident at Chernobyl, which I have some involvement in the aftermath of, which I don't think we'll need to go into here today, but in in the early 90s, I was, while associated with Los Alamos Technical Associates, that's a private sector entity at Los Alamos Laboratory, also here in Albuquerque, we had contracts with the... by then, it was the Ukrainian officials who had inherited that mess.
Right.
We were trying to get we, a private sector entity, were trying to get a coalition of national laboratories and private sector entities and the World Bank and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development to do some remediation on that accident. But anyway, the point is that the that accident, which resulted in a fire, an explosion and fire,
yeah,
because the reactor was, the RBMK, as they're called, was graphite moderated. And what actually caused all the damage, of course, was the graphite moderator caught fire. And so, and of course, the graphite moderator was highly radioactive, and so all of that radioactivity spewed out mostly into Belarus, which was to the northeast, and then but then wind changed and it went around lots of different places. Well, anyway, that one incident resulted in far more radioactive release to the atmosphere than all of the tests that we participated in. That was really a terrible thing. Of course, most of it was very short-lived, and there's no, as best anyone can tell, there have been no increases in cancer, except in the case of, you said, of thyroid cancer. And that, again, in children, and again, that was moderated quite a bit by the treatment of children in the downwind area, mostly in Belarus, for replacement of the radioactive iodine in their. Okay, but at any rate, the point of all that is that that was a far worse incident, that accident, than
the atmospheric tests.
Yeah, the atmospheric tests.
Okay, well, let's go back to
because the people were downwind, were so close, you know.
Well, actually, that makes me think of a side question that I tried to check and see if you'd ever written on this, and as far as I know, you haven't. Although that may be incorrect. I wanted to ask you, and let's just jump into that and jump back. What do you think about the question of depleted uranium being used as a weapon and having this uranium dust around and so forth? How hazardous do you think that is, or you know what do you think we should be doing? Should the weapons be banned? Or
And in fact, I have written about it over years ago. I've also written about the Chernobyl accident and how it occurred and what the results were and all that sort of thing. But in the case of depleted uranium, the first people, the first folks to use that, well, prior to World War II, the Germans invented the long rod penetrator.
Right.
And that is, I guess, the premier anti-tank weapon today. It's certainly in the guns that are in our tanks, which are our principal anti-tank weapon. That's what is used. Now, originally, you need a very dense metal, and it's essentially a flechette.
Yeah.
It's a very large flechette when you've got a
tank round. Yeah.
Yeah, 100 millimeter or 200 millimeter cannon or gun, but they're not rifles, and it's essentially it's a flechette.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Germans used them in the 1940 when they invaded Belgium, and they used it to punch holes in those forts, and they accomplished in a very short period of time what people thought probably wasn't even possible.
Wow. Hmm.
Okay, so the long rod penetrator goes back quite a while.
Yeah.
But even in World War II, near the end of the war, one of the things that, I've forgotten his name right offhand, the Minister de Armaments, the architect, can't think of his name right offhand.
Well,
but
okay.
At any rate, he was one of the orders he gave near the end of the war in 1945 was, since their nuclear weapons program was not going anywhere and they had all of this uranium metal, and depleted uranium is essentially the same as it's uranium-238. An ordinary uranium metal is like 97% U-238, so it's, to all intents and purposes, there's no difference between ordinary uranium metal and depleted uranium.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he released that from their strategic stockpile for use as long-rod penetrators.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been around since at least 1945.
That's very interesting.
Huh. I don't know...
What happened then?
The chief scientist for the Army, of course, was the first time I really looked into this to see what the history was of all of it and the development. But anyway, my view is, the answer to your question is when a long-rod penetrator goes through something, armor,
yeah,
like a tank, it's the thing has got a pointy nose, it's like a dart, and it's got fins on it because the projectile does not rotate. It's not rifled, and so it needs something to stabilize it in flight, and so it's got little fins, you know. And so what happens, I'm laughing, but it's not funny, when it goes through a tank, for
mm-hmm.
example,
mm-hmm.
it typically goes all the way through.
Huh.
And it leaves a hole where it enters that's round with those little fins there, you know. I mean, it's like a, look at it, you know, like crosshairs on a gun sight or something like that, and it just goes right on through. Well, it's pyrotechnic, though.
It's hot, yeah. It's
yeah, and so yeah. It does form inside the vehicle a vapor that you probably shouldn't breathe. It's not good for you to get uranium into your lungs in a powdered form, but it has to be almost that consistency. If it's denser, uranium metal itself is not a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's when it gets
inside,
actually the size of smoke,
right?
And it gets inhaled into the lungs, and the lungs think it's air or something like that, and then it gets embedded inside you, and then I think, and I'm not sure about this for sure, but I think the radioactivity of it. And the uranium-238 is just as radioactive as, you know, as anything else. It's very, very long-lived. It's an alpha emitter, and those alpha particles travel almost nowhere. So unless they really are intimately involved in the little sacs and stuff in your lung, they're not going to be much of a problem. But at any rate, as I've said, and almost jokingly, if you've got this thing punching a hole clear through your tank, sort of the least of your worries are whether or not you're going to have inhale some uranium dust that eventually is going to cause you some lung problems.
Right, right. That tank is, anything in that tank is toast. But then what about the troops who come by the tank afterwards and don't know about depleted uranium, and they think, huh, what's this funny dust on the tank? And they're standing taking their pictures on the tank, and then later, you know, there are a lot of service people who say that they're suffering from poisoning, whether it's heavy metal poisoning or
all the studies that I've done, and I don't know why one wouldn't believe them, that have been done over a long period of time,
mm-hmm.
beginning with the Gulf War in 91, have said that there's no basis for that.
Hmm.
There's no, they're not able to determine that anybody has got those kinds of problems. Now, I don't want to spend much more time on this because
okay.
I think it's relatively irrelevant.
Okay.
The problem we had in this country was because some people created quite a stir about the potential hazards. The Army had a range out in Arizona, where a firing range where helicopter gunships, which were firing very small flechettes,
mm-hmm.
Long rod penetrators, you know, had routinely gone around and fired them into the ground or whatever it targets. And so we were going to spend $1 zillion or so going out there and cleaning all that up, you know. And that's not too far removed from the requirement that a site where you've mined uranium be returned to a state of nature that is more pristine than it was before you mined the uranium, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to make too little of it, but all I can say is that the, I don't remember the word, but the medical studies that have been done by the Army over a long period of time now have failed so far as I know, and their sites, their websites you can go to at the Pentagon, and you know, you have to believe some of the things they tell you. Well, at any rate, I think it's a non-issue. And as I say, if you get hit with a DU round, a depleted uranium round, you know, the least of your problems is perhaps you might someday develop lung cancer.
Right. Well, that's interesting. That's a subject that I want to look into some more. It's certainly gotten a lot of attention. Okay, now back to D.C. then. And so you came to D.C. in 1972, which...
Well, not really. I think it was 74, actually.
74, okay. So that kind of puts you in the same generation as Paul Craig Roberts, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I know Craig. I used to have breakfast with him quite a lot.
Interesting.
He, at the time, he had been over at the Joint Economic Committee, and he'd come over to the Senate, and he was working for Orrin Hatch.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And most of our breakfasts were fairly confrontational because Bellman, my senator, the guy I worked for, Henry Bellman, Republican of Oklahoma, a very conservative Republican, was trying to make the budget committee work. And I don't want to get into that either. But in any case, it wasn't working very well. And to me, as best I can tell, it still doesn't work very well. And Bellman's protege, Pete Domenici of New Mexico, which was the reason I was in Washington, D.C. in the first place, he took it over. And when Bellman retired, went back to Oklahoma to be governor, and he worked, I know, 90 hours a day or something like that for years and years and years. And I don't know, I guess maybe it works better now than it did then. But and I don't want to get again to why it doesn't work and maybe why it's even a bad idea in the first place. But the point is, I think, that we were talking about Craig Roberts, and Orrin Hatch was on that committee, and he and Bellman sort of had different views about what the budget committee probably ought to do and all that sort of thing. And Bellman was trying to cooperate with Muskie, who was the chairman of the committee, and Hatch was mostly very much opposed to most of the things that Muskie wanted the budget committee to do. And Craig Roberts was... you know, he was always trying to get me to do this or that, or get Bellman to do this or that, or something like that. About the only thing I think I really did do is I think I helped get Bellman to sign on to Kemp Roth. But Craig Roberts was pretty much, I think, probably the author of the Kemp Roth tax cuts. And, of course, he worked very closely with Jack Kemp, as did I. When we went into conference, Bellman was also on appropriations, defense appropriations, and Jack Kemp was on the House side. And so we would try to coordinate our activities when we went into conference on defense appropriations.
There's an infamous name, I think, connected with Bellman's office, Joe Albaugh.
Well, you know, I vaguely remember him, but I don't remember anything else about him. I'm from Oklahoma, and I do know, you know, I have an image of somebody named Joe Albaugh. I don't remember anything else about it. And again, I don't want to waste. You know, what I really want to talk about is, in my opinion, the hijacking of the Nunn-Lugar Domenici programs and the consequences thereof. And if you don't mind,
go ahead.
That begins in 1989 when I was working again intimately with the staff of Senator Domenici. And in 89, of course, the Warsaw Pact disintegrated or disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the immediate consequences was Soviet Union withdrew its technical and other kinds of support from all of the nuclear power plants that they were building in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it also in North Korea, okay?
Right.
And withdrew their technical people, abrogated the spent fuel recycling deals and all that sort of thing. And so all these people were left right where they were. And so working with Senator Domenici, we introduced legislation, which Senator Al Gore was a co-sponsor on,
mm-hmm.
which says, okay, let's try to get a coalition of national laboratories, our national laboratories, and private sector entities to go in and try to fill this vacuum that has occurred there in Eastern Europe. And before that legislation could even get out of committee,
mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union collapsed. And so now we had a much, much more difficult problem to solve.
And then, Gordon, the driving motivation for that, for both aspects of the problem, the earlier and then the later, larger problem, is really the question of proliferation. Is that correct? Or?
Well, that and safety, too. Health, safety, and weapons proliferation of materials. We didn't know at the time, but it turns out that there were no Soviet nuclear weapons forward deployed in Warsaw Pact countries.
We always thought that there were.
Yeah, we all thought there were,
mm-hmm.
And we thought there was going to be a real problem them getting them back. Well, it turns out there weren't any. Okay, so then when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, we had a similar concern, and it turned out that, again, nuclear weapons were only in two of the former Soviet states, and that was Ukraine, principally.
Mm-hmm.
And there were ballistic missile fields in Kazakhstan that had nuclear weapons on them. So Ukraine was really the only country that was, or the only part of the Soviet Union that was no longer, you know, part of Russia,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where there was really any problem other than the actual missiles. That is, there was a test site in Kazakhstan, and there were a lot of debris and things like that. But Kazakhstan was really not particularly involved in the research development, anything like that, or stockpiling of nuclear weapons. Okay, so
people say that. And I don't know how to assess these rumors, but that, for instance, in Chechnya, you could possibly buy one of these old missiles.
Well, maybe a missile, but not a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, the Russians they had a different system for keeping track of making sure that nobody got a hold of their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to kill anybody that tried. It was a little different. So there was immediately,
mm-hmm.
and at the end of, well, let me finish what happened in 1991 in the summer, when it was still the Soviet Union. A number of legislators from the Duma or whatever it's called, you know that better than I do, came to the United States, and they talked to, among others, Senator Nunn and Lugar and Domenici,
mm-hmm.
and invited them to come over and take a look at their establishment. And they were established pretty much the same way we were in this country. And that is, we had the old Atomic Energy Commission, which eventually became the Department of Energy, but that was the civilian side of things.
Yeah.
And there's the Pentagon and the Ministry of Defense in their case. And the way things worked is the Ministry of Defense would lay requirements on MinAtom. You know, we want a nuclear weapon that has these characteristics. Can you do it?
Mm-hmm.
And then MinAtom would come back, just like the Atomic Energy Commission would be, and say, well, we think we can do this, 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 and this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
what do you think about that? And they say, okay, we'll buy it. And so then the development of the weapon, until it actually was something that you would want to put on a missile or carry in a bomber or something of that nature,
mm-hmm.
is all done by the civilian side. And so when it came time to for the Russians, I mean the Soviets, came over here and says, we want to dismantle all of these nuclear weapons and peacefully dispose of the fissile material in them, tens of thousands of the damn things, but we don't have the money. This is still the old Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so Luger and Domenici didn't actually go over there, but in any case, they went over and they took a look at it and were horrified, and they came back and they attached a rider to Conventional Forces in Europe treaty that was pending on the Senate floor, and that's the original Nunn-Luger Act, it's so-called. It was added in late November or early December of 1991, and by the time it became law, the Soviet Union was no more. I want to get a little further along on this.
Yeah.
I used to work in the Senate, and it's amazing how fast that went through the Nunn-Luger Act. But in 92, that is, 5 months later, 6 months later, already people were trying to take advantage of this Nunn-Luger Act, wherein we said, hey, it is in our national interest to help financially and technically,
mm-hmm.
the Russians, by now they were, it was Russia, dismantle these nuclear weapons and to safely and securely store them and dispose of the fissile material that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we want to do, provide them technical support to do that and financial support to do that. And you're authorized in this fiscal year, this would have been 92, fiscal 92, to expend $400 million already appropriated to the Department of Defense, because that's where the money was at the time, and that was the money that Sam Nunn had more control over than any other. But almost immediately, when you start doing that, that is making sure that you've got these nuclear weapons taken back to some secure storage and you're going to dismantle them,
mm-hmm.
the custody transfers from the Ministry of Defense to MinAtom. Like in our case, it would be transferred from the Pentagon back to the Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's where the money should have gone, and that's where it should have been spent by MinAtom. Well, almost immediately in 92, and especially after Clinton became president in 93, they began changing this program around entirely. And so over the years, of the billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars that have been spent under the name of Nunn-Luger,
mm-hmm.
almost none of it is actually gone for its originally intended purpose, which is to provide technical and financial support to the Russians to safely and securely dismantle tens of thousands of nuclear weapons and to peacefully dispose of the fissile material contained in them. It's been used by the Clinton administration as a carrot to get Ukraine to do this or that of a political nature that had nothing whatsoever to do with dismantling the nuclear weapons and peacefully disposing of the components.
So it's just been used like a slush fund to reward the Russians when we feel like it. But
in most cases, reward American contractors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was one of the worst ones that I can think of was an RFP, a request for proposal,
mm-hmm.
put out.
Yeah.
I don't remember the exact year, but it was in 94, 93, something like that, when Bill Perry was Secretary of Defense. And it was, what are we going to do with this? You American companies are invited to suggest to us what the Russians should do, or maybe in this case it was the Kazakhstanis, I'm not sure, what they should do with this missile guidance plant. And so a U.S. firm was hired to assess the proposals, the proposals that came in from American contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a selection, and the selection was that it be turned into a double cola bottling plant manufacturing site, that is, something to manufacture soda pop plants.
Hmm.
And you know, this was part of what was called, Perry called, the defense conversion of the former Soviet Union project. And Congress had to actually pass a law saying, knock off with this defense conversion. You know, that's not what we're about. That's not what we're trying to do. Okay. Well, it just keeps getting on and worse and worse and worse.
Now, Gordon, was this decommissioning of the existing weapon stockpile connected to an explicit target for arms reduction? Was there some sort of a level of how much nuclear disarmament would be reasonable that people were thinking about? Or
no, I think basically, and it's a good point, I think in one of my recent columns I went through the steps. But in 1991, while all this was going on, Bush the senior,
mm-hmm,
unilaterally ordered the withdrawal of all nuclear weapons, in tactical nuclear weapons, almost everywhere in the world, at sea or in Germany or in Korea or any place else like that,
mm-hmm,
and began, and also there were some weapons that were already scheduled to be dismantled under some SALT II or one of those arms control agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the undeployment, you know, bringing them back to the United States. And then all of the weapons that could easily be, or relatively easily, be of use to terrorists or people like that, such as the atomic demolition munitions, of which we had thousands and the Russians had thousands, those were going to be dismantled because, you know, they were exactly the sort of thing that a terrorist would want to have.
So something
like this. They were designed to be set off. They're very low yield, but they were designed to be set off by relatively unsophisticated people, like, you know, Army master sergeants or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, how large are these devices?
Well, one man couldn't carry them, so this idea of a suitcase bomb is a total fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians have denied officially. General Lebed, when he had testified before Weldon's committee here on Congress, which I observed, when he said something about them, he said they were just like ours. He called them, and he obviously knew a lot about our atomic demolition munitions. And he testified in Russian, but he had a translator there, and I don't know whether that was State Department supplied or Russian supplied. But mm-hmm, in any case,
mm-hmm,
at some point, the translator said suitcase.
Mm.
And Lebed stopped him right there, and he said, no, you know, whatever, yet, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Hmm.
And he told him again, and he explained to him. He said, and so then the translator comes back and says, I don't understand Russian. I don't understand Russian. But the translator says, oh, General says, they were footlocker, more like a soldier's footlocker, a steamer trunk, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that is the size of ours. And Lebed obviously knew the size of them.
Uh-huh.
He did say in that, but somebody heard suitcase, and that's where all this came from. And later on, some staffer who worked for Weldon even presumed to make a mock-up of what he said a suitcase nuke would be. And it's obvious if you look at this mock-up, what he's talking about is a dirty bomb. He's not talking about a fission weapon at all. It's some kind of radiological dispersal device. So anyway,
so you have
Weldon
these...
and his some staffer on his committee...
Yeah.
Is responsible for all of this nonsense about suitcase-sized nuclear weapons.
So you have these movies that have plot devices of a nuclear bomb that you can put in a backpack and someone can be running around the streets.
That's ridiculous, yeah.
Okay.
And again, these things, one of the reasons that they have such low yield, and we're talking about tons of yield, and that's what Lebed said, General Lebed said, you know, tons of yield. We're not talking about kilotons. We're talking about tons. And it's an extremely inefficient use of fissionable material, because if you wanted to make that better use of that fissile material, then you would build something that had a lot more weight to it, because that's one of the principal problems of a bomb designer, is once you assemble a supercritical mass of fissile material, then your problem is to keep it together as long as possible so that you can get the maximum number of fissions. And that gives you, and just think about it, and when you, if you have all these nuclear chain reactions going on causing fissions in the uranium or plutonium, and you're getting like 200 million electron volts of energy each fission, of each fissioning atom, half the yield of the device comes from the last generation.
It sort of sounds like a chemistry problem.
Well, I guess so. And so what the way you do that is you put something very massive around this supercritical mass so that the energy, it takes a lot of energy to blow it apart. So you got to keep it together. You compress it as much as you can and then try to keep it together and flood it with neutrons and then try to keep it together as long as you absolutely can. And, of course, what happens is it blows itself apart. In one of these, and so what happens then in an atomic demolition munition is you've expended an awful lot of fissile material to get just a few tons of yield. Well, anyway, in 1991, Bush the elder.
Right, had brought back all the stuff. And his plan was to decommission the weapons or just to store them somewhere? Or?
Well, those weapons, the ones, the ADMs and all those others, were almost immediately dismantled.
Okay.
And the Russians said in, I can't remember his name now, but the Russian Menadem deputy minister in 1992 said that they had also done the same with U.S. participation, all of theirs. And I think Sam Nunn has even talked about that, because he said in some respects the situation is more dangerous now than it was before, because although the material was in a nuclear weapon before, now it's in, I think they call them a pit, or I can't remember what it was. But at any rate, before, if you wanted to know whether or not you had all of your fissile material, you went around, at least in the case of plutonium, and you'd count the weapons. Now you don't know, because now it's so many kilograms of stuff that's stored in so many different places and all that sort of thing. Well, anyway. Okay, I got slightly off the subject there.
Let me take you a little further off the subject, to, and we can work our way back around. But you're talking about small yield devices and so forth. You've written recently about the Korean bomb, and I think just the day that your article came out, or the day after, or something. Then there was a report in the New York Times saying, okay, yeah, now we know that it was a plutonium device. So the Koreans exploded a small device. And so what a lot of people say it was a dud. Was it a dud, do you think, or was it a mini nuke? Or and what's the background on that, the plutonium uranium problem?
Well, let's see where to start. First of all, let's start with the detonation. I wrote before the test actually occurred, I think, that we knew, let's see, the Bush administration, this Bush administration, Bush the younger, began claiming almost upon coming into office that Bolton did. Undersecretary for Arms Control Bolton, now our ambassador to the United Nations, unconfirmed.
Unconfirmed, yeah.
Okay. They began claiming almost upon entering office that North Korea and Iran and Iraq had uranium based nuclear weapons programs that were secret, that the International Atomic Energy Agency, which had inspectors in all three of those countries, were never going to find. Now, that, in my view, they had a reason for that. First of all, two reasons. One, they wanted to try to discredit or bring discredit upon the International Atomic Energy Agency and its competence. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That was one of the, and that's continued to this day. They're still at it. Okay, the second one was making a plutonium implosion device that works as designed is not a slam dunk job. However, if you have enough 90%, 93% uranium-235, that is almost pure uranium-235, which is fissile. Uranium-238 is not fissile.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got, say, 120 pounds of almost pure uranium-235, you can, almost anyone can make a simple gun-type weapon where you just take 260-pound pieces and you slam them together as fast as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the same thing applies to what I said earlier. If you want to get the maximum yield, you try to keep those two pieces of uranium from blowing apart
mm-hmm.
until you've got significant yield. And the typical way to do that is to surround it with U-238, which is very, very dense, about the densest thing there is, and it takes an awful lot of energy to blow the U-235 apart. I've often done experiments on what are called burst reactors, and one in particular is called the Godiva for obvious reasons. It consists of two hemispheres
mm-hmm.
of almost pure U-235 that are very slowly brought together. And then when all of a sudden, if there's a chain reaction that goes on, they blow apart. And, of course, you know, they kill anybody that's in the room, but this thing is conducted in a well-shielded facility. There's no nuclear explosion, but there is a measurable fission reaction, and you get basically the same thing in terms of the gamma ray output and all the other kind of things that you get from, and a fission spectrum, that you get from, but it doesn't really damage the two hemispheres, and you can do these experiments over and over again. I don't know how many, but 1,000 or so.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and that's typically what we would use to calibrate our detectors that we were going to use on bomb tests because, you know, everything was just right. Okay. But it's called Godiva because these are naked hemispheres.
Ah, I see.
Together.
Okay, yeah.
But and there are others that are, you use other mechanisms. There's some of them are cylindrical and some of them the whole point is that it's relatively easy with uranium-235 to if you've got two subcritical pieces, almost critical pieces. If you get them together, you're going to get a nuclear excursion or whatever you want to call it. Okay. So one of the reasons for claiming that the North Koreans had a secret uranium enrichment project was because if they did have, then making a nuclear weapon would be within their capabilities. That is, they could do a gun-type weapon.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians doubted and have doubted up until now that the Koreans all by themselves could actually make a plutonium implosion device. It's just in their view, the Russian view, and they're the ones who supplied them with the 5-megawatt plutonium producing reactor.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to, it was the Soviet Union who did it, but and that's another interesting thing. As soon as the Soviet Union collapsed, the Russians required the North Koreans to submit that reactor and all of the associated activities to an IAEA safeguards agreement, International Atomic Energy Safeguards Agreement.
And inspections and so forth.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They were already a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but they had never done, as required by that treaty, negotiated a safeguards agreement with the IAEA. Well, it was during the negotiations for that safeguards agreement that these disputes arose between, as you can imagine, between this hermit kingdom, and this was the father now when they started, Kim Jong-il, but the father.
Kim Il-sung, yeah.
And there got to be a dispute, and Hans Blix was then the director general of the IAEA, and they were just coming off of discovering that there had been a secret uranium enrichment project in Iraq. Now, that's not the IAEA's fault to go around finding out that there are secret programs somewhere in the world. All they're required to do, and their job up until then, up until 1991-92, was to simply verify that the materials, the fissile materials and all special nuclear materials that could be transformed either chemically or physically into something that would go in a reactor or a bomb or something like that, were accounted for, and that none of them were being used in pursuit of a nuclear program. If you don't have the requisite amount of U-235 or U-233, which is also an even rarer isotope, which you can make nuclear weapons with, and which you can, we'll go into that later, but the, many of the uranium, the reactors that the Indians have are thorium reactors that make U-233.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so anyway, back to, if you don't have the requisite amount of fissile material, U-235, or plutonium-239, you ain't going anywhere. And so that's one of the things that makes keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists relatively simple. You just make sure you don't have to worry too much about plutonium-239, because a terrorist is not going to be able to make a nuclear weapon with 239. I doubt seriously that the North Koreans have, and the Russians have doubted it, the whatever it takes to make a deliverable plutonium-239 device. Certainly they haven't shown thus far that they have that capability. And I just can't imagine why they would have taken. We know how much plutonium-239 they've got, because we know it all came from that 5-megawatt reactor, and we know how long it's operated. And it's not possible, really, for them to have more than enough to make, at most, 10 implosion devices with that. Well, they've now blown at least 10% or whatever they've got. And if Bush were really serious or about anything else, if he took out that reactor, then there would never be any more. So right off the bat, as I said in one article, I don't, not the one you've read recently, but one that appeared at antiwar.com, you know, it just didn't make any sense for them to test it, because if the thing was a failure, well, then it was a failure. But as long as they didn't test it, then we'd never know. We'd be just like we are with the Israelis. We don't know for sure what they've got. But in any case, they did test one. I don't know why. And apparently it vented a bit. They didn't have complete containment. It was an underground test. But it apparently vented. At least that's what our government tells us. And they, and our government tells us that they have done a cloud sampling, that they have now got what amounts to a radiochemical analysis of that test. And so if that's all true, then they know what kind of weapon it was and how, and a lot about how it was designed by looking at the
debris,
looking at the radiochemical analysis. So they know, and if they say it was subkiloton, I guess that's what it was. I don't know. Russians continue to say, well, our seismic yield says it was greater than that, so I don't know. But I got slightly off the subject again, as I'm wont to do.
No, that's okay. This
anyway,
is quite interesting, actually.
Starting with this administration, Bush Jr., they came in claiming that North Korea and Iran and Iraq mm-hmm. had these undetected by the International Atomic Energy Agency.
These uranium programs, yeah.
The uranium nuclear weapons programs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out that we know that Iraq did not. We had to go in there and invade the place and kill hundreds of thousands of people and look at the mess that there is now. And it turns out that we all know, you and I know, that they didn't have a uranium enrichment nuclear weapons program at the time we invaded.
Yeah, before, yeah. Yeah.
And I want to come back to that because they knew, the people that engineered this war, knew that when they came into office.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go back to that in a second if you don't mind.
Sure.
But then the same claims have been made without any basis whatsoever about Iran and continue to be made about Iran, that Iran's got some hidden uranium nuclear weapons program that the IAEA can't find any trace of. And then here we are in Korea, and now was the chance, you know. If they really did have a uranium enrichment nuclear weapons program, boy, now's the time to show it, because if they have such a program, it is so well hidden that nobody knows, hasn't got a clue as to where it is.
Right.
Which, as I say in one of my articles, the most logical reason for us not being able to have any idea where this program is that it doesn't exist.
Right.
But
right.
Suppose for a second that it had existed. Well, then anybody who's got 120 pounds of uranium-235 can make a nuke, and it's going to work. And it's probably going to give you 10 to 20 kilotons of yield, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you don't know where this program
yeah.
is. You
yeah.
don't know how much of it, how much uranium-235 they were capable of making. There's no way, except going in and invading it like we did Iraq, that you're ever going to uncover this program if it exists, okay?
Well, you've got the North Koreans scaring their neighbors, and the Japanese are saying now, okay, well, don't worry about us. We're not going to go nuclear. But let's just say hypothetically, if the North Koreans continued a series of tests and demonstrated greater proficiency, and then the Japanese decided, well, okay, we will go nuclear ourselves. How long do you think it would take them to switch over their civilian nuclear power programs to be able to produce a bomb? Would that happen very quickly if they wanted, or?
No, I don't agree with that at all. The people who say that are the same people that say, and again, Sikorsky and a lot of other people have been claiming this since 1995, that
mm-hmm.
it is relatively easy to operate an ordinary light water reactor, power reactor, like the kind we've got all over this country and all over the world,
yeah.
To recover plutonium from that reactor and make a nuclear weapon with it. To the best of my knowledge, no one has ever done that. No one in their right mind would do that. And it would involve operating a reactor right under the noses of the International Atomic Energy Agency in a very peculiar manner. Let me just explain how.
Okay.
Typically, you start out with a full load of fuel in one of these reactors,
mm-hmm.
and after about 2 years, the way they are operated nowadays, the reactor shut down for a while, and a third of the refuel is replaced. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you've got out of the reactor a third of the fuel loading, and then you start it back up again. And then you go another couple of years, and then you take out another third
mm-hmm.
and replace it. And then finally you go 2 more years, so now you're 6-7 years down the pike, and you've now got a full load of fuel that was only in the reactor for say, some of it for 2 years, some of it four, some of it six. Okay.
Yeah.
Only that first load, would you have any, that first third, would you have any chance at all of being able to separate out the plutonium that you could conceivably, somehow or another, make a nuclear weapon with? And, it's just not doable. The way you do it in, say, the Soviet reactor that went south, and like our production reactors, is you operate the reactor in such a mode that you more or less continuously replace fuel elements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the accident at Chernobyl was so bad, is because since you're going in there and replacing fuel elements almost continuously on a day-to-day basis, not leaving the fuel in there very long,
mm-hmm.
ensuring that you make the right kind of plutonium and you don't have all of these other things that get added in over that sort of long period of time,
mm-hmm.
you can't have a containment vessel on it, or at least the Soviets and the United States never figured out how to do that.
Hmm.
Because, you know, you got to... And so the RBMK reactor at Chernobyl...
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, didn't have a containment
right.
vehicle.
No, that I knew, but I didn't know why. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's why.
Uh-huh.
Now, they weren't operating it in that mode to make plutonium for nuclear weapons, but the reactor nevertheless was capable of being operated that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, if Bushehr, for example, the reactor in Iran that the Russians are building right now,
yeah,
what they would have to do, if the Iranians were serious, is once they got that reactor up and operating,
yeah,
with its first full load, then they would have to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty, kick out the IAEA inspectors, and operate that reactor full bore for 6 to 9 months, then shut it down, then recover plutonium from all of the spent fuel elements that were in that reactor that had been in there, say, as much as 9 months,
mm-hmm.
then they might have enough plutonium of the right form with which to make a few nuclear weapons, if they knew how to make nuclear implosion weapons or something like that. But, you know, you can't do all that stuff without... you got to withdraw from the treaty, which... And then you got to kick out the IAEA inspectors. And by the way, the non-proliferation treaty requires the non-nuclear weapon states to negotiate a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the IAEA agreements existed before the non-proliferation treaty existed. The IAEA predates the non-proliferation treaty by about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There are, ordinarily then, an IAEA safeguards agreement is for, I can't say the word, forever, okay?
Perpetuity,
as
activity
exists, for as long as these materials exist, the agreement is in force. But with an agreement that is negotiated by virtue of being a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that agreement is null and void the moment that the country withdraws from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So when the North Koreans withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty
mm-hmm.
in 2003, threatened to do it in 1992, and actually did it in January 2003, their IAEA safeguards agreement, which was enforced but not fully enforced because they were still in the process of negotiating the terms of it, was null and void. So I'm looking right now at the UN Security Council resolution. I think it's 17-06, but it's the one that's just been passed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is weird. This is what it says. Acting under Chapter 7 of the Charter of the United Nations and taking measures... under its Article 41. Now, that means something, and we can talk about that if you want to, but then it says, first article under that, condemns the nuclear test, okay. Second article, demands that the DPRK not conduct any further nuclear test or launch of a ballistic missile, okay. Then third demand, demands that the DPRK, North Koreans, immediately retract its announcement of withdrawal from the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. And number four, this is the last demand, demands further that the North Korea return to the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons and, and International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards, and underlines the need of for all states parties, sorry, I have to scroll.
That's all right.
To the treaty on, to comply with their treaty obligations. Okay, well, you know, there isn't anything in Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, especially under Article 41, that gives anybody the right to demand that North Korea return to the Treaty on Non-Proliferation. You know, it's a sovereign state.
Mm-hmm.
It withdrew. I'm not saying this is the right thing to do, but I think the Bush administration wanted them to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I think that, the Bush is trying to provoke Iran into withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and tried to provoke Iraq into withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so that it would be free to take unilateral action against them, or perhaps sanctioned by the UN Security Council, like this stuff right here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
well, invoking Article 7 is significant, but then the qualifier, Chapter 7, but the qualifier is the article there, right?
That's right. And the way it's supposed to work is somebody makes a complaint to the Security Council, says that these actions or threaten the peace and security in the region or something like that. So then the Security Council meets, and then they deliberate, and then they decide under Article 39, which is part of Chapter 7, whether or not there is such a thing as a threat to peace in the region or something of that nature. The Security Council has never done that in the case of North Korea. It's never done that in the case of Iran. It did in the case of Iraq, of course. Okay. So once you have decided that there is a threat to the peace in the region, then you can decide on what you're going to do. And Article 41 allows you to have up until sanctions. You know, that's the strongest thing, not use of force.
Right, right, right.
And Article, oh gosh, is it 42 or 40? I can't recall now. Well, one of the others, articles on either side of that, I think it's 42. It authorizes the use of force. But so there's 39. Then under Article 40, which is, it's Article 40, it says, before making this determination under Article 39 that there is a peace, that there is a threat to the peace in the region, and therefore being able to invoke sanctions under Article 41 or use of force under Article 42, the Security Council may do a lot of other things. This is under Article 40, before ever making such a determination.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they've done in the case of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't even done that in the case of North Korea.
Right, right. Well, okay, so
all technical, but
you described the plutonium track. Well, what about the uranium track?
Well, there's no evidence at the moment that either North Korea,
mm-hmm,
or Iran have an illicit uranium enrichment program. Now, in the case of North Korea, it's not illicit. They're no longer a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They can do any damn thing they want to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you've described this in some of your articles, the requirements for producing enriched uranium, tens of thousands of cascading centrifuges. And I don't know, are there any more modern ways to produce enriched uranium these days? Or what are the options available if they wanted to try that?
Well, at the present time, the United States has never, ever gotten up to anything as modern as enrichment by gas centrifuges. The United States is no longer in the uranium enrichment business. There's a private, semi-private sector entity that's now in charge of what remaining facilities we have in this country, and they are all gaseous diffusion which consumes enormous amounts of electricity.
Right.
Our gas diffusion plants were originally in the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority.
And up by the Hoover Dam, yeah.
For that reason, because there was so much electricity there.
Well, actually, that makes me think of a question that I wanted to ask you, too, and that is that is in your knowledge of the history of the whole development of the nuclear industry, is there any reason to think that maybe building the TVA and the Hoover Dam was motivated in part by an anticipation of the need to provide electricity for refining uranium?
I don't know that much about TVA, but I would say no.
Oh, okay.
I can't imagine that anybody would have anticipated, when you read about it, it's still just incredible that it was actually done, the whole Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
Leslie Groves, it's just an incredible achievement. Now, we had, and got a little off the subject, but the Iraqis had a secret program, which was secret primarily because they kept it secret because nobody figured that anybody would do such a thing. In the early days of the Manhattan Project, when they realized they needed this 90% highly enriched uranium, they essentially dismantled the Berkeley cyclotron and carted it away to be used as a huge mass spectrometer, wherein the masses of uranium were separated out, 235 from 238.
Mm-hmm.
That device and others were built like it were called calutrons. Cal because Berkeley, that's where the mm-hmm. cyclotron was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it was called calutron. And a certain amount of uranium was actually made at Oak Ridge early on before the gas centrifuge, before the gaseous diffusion plants were completed. And nobody thought much about it. That was not even classified, I believe, and it was in the open literature. And since it was primarily a mass spectrometer, there have been calutrons built in various countries since then for the purpose of isotope separation, not uranium enrichment, but just plain old isotope separation. And in the Soviet Union now, in Russia now and in the old Soviet Union, there were a number of gas centrifuge operations that were they were isotope separation plants, not uranium at all. They had nothing to do, whatever, with nuclear weapons. It was just there were various reasons you needed certain isotopes that you could separate out if you could put it in some form like uranium hexafluoride that was a gas that you could put in these centrifuges. Okay.
So the evolution of the technology is from gaseous diffusion to cascading centrifuges, and then is there a sort of a next generation type of technology past that?
Well, there is, but as far as I know, nobody's ever implemented it, and that's laser isotope separation.
Uh-huh.
Once again, we built prototypes in this country, but we never ever did it. We never ever built a facility that would enrich uranium, or I don't believe we even commercially separate isotopes that way of any kind, not just uranium.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say, we never ever got in this country that felt the need for, didn't ever build a gas centrifuge uranium enrichment plant. When I worked for Senator Bellman, he was advocating that we do that at a place called Camp Gruber in Oklahoma, which was an underused or unused National Guard training site or something like that.
Yeah.
Kerr McGee, an Oklahoma entity, was going to do that. Well, it never, ever occurred because when nuclear power got killed in this country, there wasn't any need anymore for additional uranium enrichment facilities. There are two, there are three really important uranium enrichment activities using gas centrifuges in the world today. One of them is called Urenco, and that's it's a anyway, it's European, then the Russians have almost all of their uranium enrichment activities are gas centrifuge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that there are the Pakistanis.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, then the Chinese also apparently have uranium enrichment activities of some sort. And I think all of these use gas centrifuges because it uses like a tenth the electricity of the old gaseous diffusion processes.
Yeah.
And, you know, okay.
But it's not a trivial problem for the Iranians or the North Koreans to acquire secondhand gas centrifuges and to set them up properly and so forth, right?
Well, not only that, but I think it's probably very difficult because of the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Iran and on North Korea ever since. Well, in the case of North Korea, they go back 50 years.
Right.
In the case of Iran, they go back 25 years, or at least 20. More like 25 years now. We've essentially had fairly rigorous sanctions imposed by the United States, which we impose on foreign companies that attempt to supply anything we don't want them to have, the North Koreans and the Iranians.
Well, of course, when Cheney was in charge of Halliburton, he was busy trying to sell stuff to Iran, though.
It could be. I don't know. But in the Clinton administration, when Yeltsin was president, the Russians had agreed, signed contracts, to provide the Iranians essentially a turnkey gas centrifuge uranium enrichment plant, and also the reactor that they're still building at Bushehr. Clinton tried to get them to stop both of those on the ground. I can't remember what his rationale was, but in any case, both of them were perfectly legal under the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
both
mm-hmm.
of those activities were Iran's right to have. They would have been safeguarded. There was no question of that. The IAEA would have been looking over their shoulders every step of the way. But in any case, the Russians were talked into not providing them the gas centrifuge uranium enrichment plant. Similarly, the Chinese had agreed to provide them, the Iranians, with a uranium conversion facility, that is to take yellow cake, so-called uranium oxides, and to convert them into a gas that could be mm-hmm. used in mm-hmm. the uranium hexafluoride, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which could be used in these centrifuges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Chinese were strong-armed into canceling that agreement.
It's just like we strong-armed the Japanese recently into not developing an Iranian oil field, sort of a track record of preventing the kind of trade that would help support the Iranian government, I guess.
What's even worse than that, there's a U.S. law that makes it, that allows the president to impose sanctions. In fact, I think it's the other way around. He has to he has to justify not imposing sanctions, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
For any company or country that invests $20 million or more in a whole range of things, but particularly in the energy sector in Iran.
So Gordon, what you're saying is that if the Iranians pursued their development of nuclear power,
yeah.
that under most reasonable circumstances, it's hard to envision them making some kind of a switch over to producing bombs that perhaps they have a reasonable need for nuclear power just as other countries do and that kind of thing.
Well, I wouldn't want to judge why they're doing what they're doing or whether they have any need or not, but this is without question true. It would be impossible for them
mm-hmm.
to operate the reactor at Bushehr or their gas centrifuge cascades that they are still in the process of learning how to operate,
mm-hmm.
under the watchful eyes of continuous monitors and IAEA inspections without the IAEA knowing it. And so whenever you know, they'd know it.
Yeah.
Immediately. And there's just no way that it could be done otherwise. To give you an idea, the way uranium enrichment works is you essentially cast out the U-238. It's not enrichment. What it is, it's... And so what you come out of the other end, since 97 point whatever it is, I can't remember the exact number, 97.3% of the uranium that you put into that, the uranium hexafluoride that you put in one end of that gaseous centrifuge,
mm-hmm.
is stuff you don't want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It gets discarded. And so the stuff that comes out the end is, you know, it's like 1% or less of what you put in. You'd have to be, you don't even have to do a chemical assay to notice the difference between having 100 tons come out the other end of 3%, let's say, uranium, enriched uranium, or 1 ton of, I hadn't done the numbers recently, but let's say it's something like that, you know. All of a sudden, there's nothing coming out the other end,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or very little's coming out the other end. And so you immediately, you can quickly assay what it is. Doesn't take that much time, or, you know, do a mass spectrometer or something like that, or a gas chromatograph or something like that, and you'll know what the enrichment level is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are cameras in there all the time. That's another thing, you know. We keep saying, well, it's really a cover for a nuclear weapons program. Well, at Natanz, which is the one they're talking about using nuclear weapons to wipe out because it's underground, you know, under, I don't know, you get different numbers, 10 meters of earth or something like that.
Yeah.
If you're a journalist and you want to go down there, you've got an open invitation from the Iranian government to go take a look at that thing,
mm-hmm.
that plant at Natanz, which is empty. The only thing in that room, the last I heard, are the IAEA environmental monitors. You know, it's a great big empty damn place. And if we're going to start a nuclear war over killing, destroying an underground bunker that's empty, you know, everybody's lost their minds in this country.
What
everybody.
What would be the effect of that if the neocons had their way, which I'm at this point, I have to tell you, I'm starting to think that they're not going to have their way on Iran, but I
hope you're right.
I hope I'm right too. But I mean, given the catastrophe that they've created in Iraq, you can't really underestimate their destructive potential. But if they got their way on Iran and we attacked Iran and then sort of went the extra step and then used low-yield earth penetrator nukes, what would be the effect of that on sort of the world proliferation environment? How would the U.S. cope with the after effects of that?
I don't know. And one of the reasons we've got a long way away from the non-Luger Dmitrovsky programs.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I know, because I know him fairly well, Pete Domenici, senator from New Mexico, and I worked with he and his staff for, gosh, all the time I was in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and I still see him occasionally now that I'm back in New Mexico. But he, Clinton Anderson from New Mexico, the senator he replaced, was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission for a long time and had a lot to do with the buildup in our nuclear weapons program and a lot to do with, well, in Los Alamos is in New Mexico, and
mm-hmm.
Sandia National Laboratories is in New Mexico. And I think most people think that it had a lot to do, that program had a lot to do with, quote-unquote, winning the Cold War. I know that Senator Domenici would like to have as his legacy the bill down of that capability, which is no longer needed.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the things that I think he's been very in the forefront on. And it is just, I don't know, I can't speak for him, but I know it is disheartening to lots of us that have been in the nuclear weapons program to see the way it is being used as a, I don't know what you'd call it, what is it when it's a false, it's a premise, it's a, you know, they have the neo-crazies and even the regime change act, human rights activists, the no nuclear power anywhere in the world. All of these people have seized upon these non-existent nuclear weapons programs as their rationale for doing what they're doing.
It's sort of a mystery.
And it just pains us in the community to have what we've done distorted or misused in such a manner, you know.
Well, it's a sort of a Mephistophelian bargain if you think you're going to be able to use nukes in some sort of a very calculated way and coerce people. You're way outside the logic of deterrence as it was understood for a long time, and the consequent there are many sort of unintended consequences to that, I think.
Yeah, well, all the time I was in the program, which was in the build-up days, so to speak,
yeah,
and I went to Washington, nothing really significant, in my opinion, has happened in the nuclear weapons program since then.
Yeah.
Till we started the build-down, and then that's when I got associated again and started on the way down. But anyway, during my years in the community, we were always trying to make these devices usable for the deterrent purposes, and that means two things. You have to make a nuclear weapon that can knock out hardened missile silos that contain nuclear warheads. Okay, that's the number one objective. Then the second objective was to build an anti-ballistic missile device that can knock down incoming ballistic missiles that you didn't manage to knock out in the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those were the two major thrusts. Almost everything else was, one spent any time trying to figure out how to kill more people.
So the logic of that is that you preclude a second strike capacity, and so the problem then simplifies into a stalemate with a mutual assured destruction, right?
I think that's correct, yeah. And so far as I know, we never targeted populations, or at least not in the era in which I was involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you still are hearing talk about, well, they've got these underground things and we don't know where they are for sure, but by God, we're going to have to use a nuclear weapon if we expect to knock them out wherever they are.
Yeah. So
that's just scary.
To take the old logic and to reapply it to our current circumstances, some people, and I think perhaps most notably, the former head of NSA, General Odom, has said quite seriously, although I think most people have taken this just as some sort of strange kind of humor, that we ought to just give nuclear weapons to Iran.
I didn't know he'd said that. Well, there was somebody who seriously said, you know, if the Iraqis really want to try to enrich uranium using calutrons, which is the way they tried to do it, because that was in the open literature,
yeah,
we ought to help them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such an idiotic thing to do. And they never made more than gram quantities of enriched uranium, and so far as I know, never made any weapons grade, almost pure U-235.
Right.
They might never have. At the time of the war, 91, the cascades of calutrons that they had operating had been down and were being disassembled because they weren't operating correctly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that they would ever have fixed them. It's not obvious that they ever would have. Well, I don't know. We got all... But let me go back again to the way in which, in my opinion, the attempts, the use, the misuse of the Nunn-Lugar-Domenici programs, the Russian programs, so-called, the misuse of them is actually as a reason or a rationale for doing something that somebody else wanted for some other reason, like regime change in Iran or North Korea or Libya or wherever. It has, in my opinion, resulted in the chances of terrorists getting their hands on a nuclear weapon being greater now than they were 15 years ago when we began this program.
A weapon or even just loose material?
Well, I don't think that, if you could get 120 pounds of almost pure uranium-235, then I think a terrorist could make a nuclear weapon. It wouldn't, maybe the yield would only be like the one that just went off that they tested in North Korea, sub-kiloton. I don't know. But I don't worry at all about them getting plutonium. Mm-hmm. That's beyond their capability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anybody's. It's even, in my opinion, may even be beyond the capabilities of North Korea. Now, I know that there's a national intelligence estimate, according to Cy Hirsch, on North Korea, which was published, which was constructed or made in the summer of 2002, at the same time as the completely flawed national intelligence estimate for Iraq was being constructed or put together.
Yeah.
With all of the flaws that the ones that we now know the Iraqi one had, but in that, according to Cy Hirsch, I've never seen it, and I don't suppose he has either, but he's been told by people who know that the one on North Korea, and he... his article in the New Yorker that in January of 2003, that's on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, was called Cold Test. That was the name of the article. And in that article, he says that this national intelligence estimate claims that Pakistan helped them do that, that is, develop an implosion, a high explosive implosion system that used uranium-238 rather than U-235. And, of course, that wouldn't mean there would be no yield whatsoever, but the metallurgical properties of U-238 are very similar to 235. And so if you had a design for a U-235 implosion device that you could do all of those necessary things, which apparently the North Koreans have not done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even if the North... Okay, he claims that the Pakistanis did that. The Pakistanis adamantly deny having done that. There's no evidence that they've done that. And even if they had given them a... helped them with designing an implosion system for U-235, you couldn't just take that system and insert plutonium-239 in it and expect it to work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The mass is substantially different. The critical mass of plutonium is substantially less than that of U-235. The metallurgical properties are very different. And Sid Hecker, former director of Los Alamos, was invited and went over to North Korea in 2004. That's a year after the invasion of Iraq. And they proudly showed him some of the plutonium that they had recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Sig, who's also a metallurgist, it appears that they had learned how to alloy the plutonium 239 with I think it's gallium, which makes it machinable, because you got to make things out. You got to make a sphere out of this stuff.
Yeah,
and it's got to be he even points out, Sig does, in his report back to Congress when he got back here, that they seem to even know that they needed to have a certain phase of plutonium, delta phase it's called, because the hydrodynamic properties, the metallurgical properties of the delta phase are different from the other phases of plutonium. So it's a very, very difficult thing to build an implosion plutonium device the first time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it looks like they haven't done it. And they've wasted, you know,
well, if
at least a tenth of the total material that they've got.
If we were going to start with the sort of a clean slate and to put together a new kind of inspection or proliferation anti-proliferation regime, what would be the key things to do if we were going to have a better process?
Well, the only reason we need the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has a lot of bad things in it, is that everybody who signed that has agreed to abide by, to negotiate with and abide by the IAEA Safeguards Agreement. Now, right now there's a big issue in India because India has never been a signatory to that treaty.
Right.
It's probably never going to be, but it has safeguarded activities already.
And it hasn't proliferated.
Well, but the point is those safeguarded activities are in, I can't say that word again, perpetuity or whatever the word is.
Perpetuity, yeah.
Yeah, since they've never been a signatory to the treaty, then the safeguards agreement is not contingent upon their continued membership. Okay, now in the deal that we've offered India, that Condi offered India.
Right.
In order to get them to cancel the gas pipeline to Iran and to participate in interdiction, search and seizure on the high seas of any kind of activities that we don't like the looks of,
right?
They're required to put certain activities, make them certain activities subject to safeguards. There are a list of them. I don't know right offhand, but like 10 reactors and a whole bunch of other stuff. But those agreements, the IAEA is demanding now, these are the standard IAEA agreements that are not NPT connected, and they are forever. You can never, ever say, okay, now we're kicking you guys out now because we're taking this out of the safeguards regime. And that's a big issue right now, at least. As long as we've got an International Atomic Energy Agency, it's a big issue. And except for the fact, as I say, that the Non-Proliferation Treaty requires all these countries to have these safeguards agreements, it's probably in the way, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Because there's really no enforcement mechanism involved in it. The Non-Proliferation Treaty depends completely upon the enforcement mechanism that's built into the IAEA statute, which pre-exists the treaty by like 20 years. And the statute is what says that the IAEA fundamental goal is to facilitate a transfer, safe, secure use of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. That's their fundamental goal. But their secondary goal, their secondary mission is, insofar as they're able, they're to ensure that none of this stuff ever gets used for a military purpose. Whenever they suspect that anything has been used, and there's no reason whatsoever to suppose that anything in Iran has been so used as of now, they make a report, first of all, to the IAEA Board of Governors, and then the Board of Governors then in turn makes a report to the UN Security Council.
Is it really realistic anymore to think that we have to maintain a small closed club of nuclear powers, or are there other ways, do you think, that...
Well, see, the IAEA isn't that way. I don't remember exactly what the membership is, but it's like the membership of the United Nations, General Assembly. And so the only thing that enters into the play is that once this report has been made by the IAEA board to the UN Security Council, which it illegally did in the case of Iran last year, or was it earlier this year? I've forgotten.
Well, I think it was last year, but I'm not certain of that.
But anyway, there's nothing in the IAEA statute that says that, you know, the IAEA Board of Governors report to the UN Security Council, which they talked about missiles, talked about, which is none of the IAEA's business. It talked about the six-party I'm sorry, the EU3 talks, mm-hmm. The Germans, Brits, and French yeah. talks that have nothing to do with the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's none of their business. They have no business whatsoever requiring Iran to return to those talks, which is what the IAEA board did last year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then when the Iran says, to heck with you, then they referred this report, this requirement that they made, to the UN Security Council. And the UN Security Council says, well, you know, in the interest of settling this dispute without making a determination as to whether who's right or who's wrong, well, we decided that maybe you ought to honor this IAEA request without ruling or whatever on the legality of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what I'm trying to say is this has been deliberate by Bolton and this administration to misuse, to, what's the word? I don't know, corrupt, I guess. First, the IAEA Board of Governors,
mm-hmm.
which have now done things which they have no authority whatever to do, and the IAEA is a UN agency, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they got the UN Security Council basically to say, okay, well, you know, we're not going to make a judgment about who's right or wrong about this, but why don't you, Iran, you know, comply with these guys?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just in the interest of, you know, whatever. And now here we have, in the case of North Korea, the United States getting the UN Security Council to say to do something that has no authority whatever to do, which is to require North Korea to return to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, you can't do that legally, but they've done it. Well, what this all means is, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
is that this is part of the plan to essentially. You know, the UN Security Council might have been somewhat useful. With the end of the Cold War in 91, beginning of 92,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, even going back into the Clinton administration, Clinton era,
right,
the UN Security Council and the UN in general was something that was no longer as useful as it had been during the Cold War. It was a creature that was to somehow or another, you know. Well, anyway. And when the Bush administration came by 2003, they had developed, first of all, in 2002, they had the National Security Strategy for Combat of Weapons of Mass Destruction or something or other was the title of it. This was September of 2002, as I recall. But anyway, soon after the invasion of Iraq, the Proliferation Security Initiative was announced by Bolton, who was one of the principal authors of it.
What you're describing is an increasing unilateralism by the United States.
Oh, absolutely, without any question, and deliberate. At the 2005
mm-hmm.
Review conference for the Non-Proliferation Treaty,
mm-hmm.
First of all, Condi Rice, our Secretary of State, didn't even attend, didn't even address it. It was held in New York City.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very important thing. And in that 2005 review conference, the results of the 2000 review conference, held while Clinton was president, were not even allowed to be discussed, much less were the recommendations and the minutes or whatever you want to call it, of the 2000 conference, affirmed. They weren't even discussed. They weren't even brought up. Then Rademacher, one of her Condi's weenies over there in the State Department,
yeah.
Maybe you know him, I don't know.
No, I know the name. But I don't
yeah,
know.
Well, anyway, he goes in there, and essentially he presents them a harangue for replacing the Non-Proliferation Treaty in its present form. If it couldn't be modified to meet Bush's demands, with the Proliferation Security Initiative, which is essentially a coalition of the willing, which now I understand has as many as 60 members, and both India and South Korea are being strong-armed into becoming full-fledged members of it.
Hmm.
And it's going to be, the only way to describe it is international piracy.
Yeah.
If somebody like Bolton decides that the ship might have some suspicious cargo on it, they're going to just board it, and confiscate anything they don't like the looks of and things of that nature.
Now, Gordon, I follow your logic on this, and I agree with you, I think, pretty much all along the way. But what do your former colleagues and so forth say? I mean, here you are. You've worked in various capacities for the Republicans, you probably even describe yourself as conservative in your political orientation. And
Yeah. So
what do – here you are lambasting the administration in a terrific way, I think. But what do your friends say, or your people you used to work with in Washington? Are you accused of abandoning your viewpoints, or?
Well, you talked to Craig, and he's even stronger on these matters than I am, Craig Roberts.
Yes.
And I'm watching Craig. If he disappears, then I'm going to start worrying.
Well, I shouldn't laugh. Yeah. So it doesn't bother you at all when people criticize you. You're being consistent.
Well, one of the reasons I came back to New Mexico was, despite everything I had done and tried to do, and there are a number of us in that arena, went to war with Iraq under false pretenses. I go into that a little bit about they knew. They knew when they went in there. They knew as early, you can look at my columns, as early as the summer of 2002, at a time we now know when they were preparing this cooked-up national intelligence estimate on Iraq.
Yeah.
It was already obvious to me where we were going, but I didn't say so in those many words because I always thought, well, they just don't really understand, If we really explain to them that what the situation is and how ridiculous these charges are about the nuclear weapons program in Iraq, we'll stop this war. Well, just about late December, early January, is when the rest of us found out what these people had known since 1995. And you probably know it now. Maybe you knew it earlier. In 1994, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, General Kamal, essentially defected to Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And he took with him a cousin, or maybe it was a brother, I'm not sure, who was also in the military. And they took thousands of documents with them. And they were debriefed, as they say in the vernacular,
right,
by the IAEA. I forget the guy's name now, but he was the head of the IAEA action team on Iraq, extensively, and by the CIA, and by MI6, and probably by Mossad. I don't know about Mossad, but I know about the IAEA. And in December or so of 2002, we now know or suspect Scott Ritter, former
weapons inspector,
Marine, U.S. Yeah. Marine, and inspector of Russian demilitarization programs, and also UNSCOM inspector, chief inspector of UNSCOM. He may have had something to do with the leaking of the minutes, the minutes,
mm-hmm,
of the debriefing by Kamal to the IAEA. And that was leaked in December of 2002 on the eve of the war. And there are a lot of stories about it in January, and I wrote a couple of columns on the subject. But anyway, the substance of all this was that in 94, he told these intelligence weenies and the IAEA that on Saddam Hussein's orders, all of their so-called weapons of mass destruction programs were destroyed as fast as they could in the beginning in 1991. most of them destroyed even before the IAEA inspectors or the UNSCOM inspectors ever appeared in Iraq.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and he had
mm-hmm.
all this documentation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
And so then the next thing that happened was Saddam Hussein, upon hearing that his son-in-law had defected, gave orders. We now know after the war, after the invasion, we had access to all these documents, and they're now known to be legitimate. And what he said was, in these orders, we don't know how much he's told the IAEA or the Americans. Therefore, I order you to dump everything you've got in your files onto UNSCOM and onto IAEA. You know, just completely open your books so that everybody will know that we don't have any weapons of mass destruction programs. And so they did that.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of my working hypothesis that the neocons are not completely stupid, and that they knew perfectly well that they were going to create the kind of mess that we've gotten, and that they had no intention of accomplishing the kinds of things that they sold the war on the basis of. What they really wanted was a disturbance and instability, and that's what they got. I may be wrong about that, but it seems to me more likely that they had intended from the beginning to create the kind of mess that we have, rather than it being just a mistake or stupidity. I don't know.
Yeah, that's your area of expertise, and I'll confine myself to mine, but I tend to agree with you. But in any case, so what did the IAEA do with all this information that it got from Kamal, the son-in-law,
mm-hmm.
and then all the other additional information that started pouring in on them from Saddam Hussein? Well, they checked it all out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as a result of that, by 1997, it's just as Hans Blix was retiring as Director General of the IAEA, and Mohammed al-Baradei, the Egyptian, was coming in.
Right.
And I don't remember exactly who it was, but I think it was al-Baradei who essentially reported to the UN Security Council, hey, it's all gone. You know, this is what there was, and this is the result of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that assessment stands to this day, and as a result. And something almost the same was done by UNSCOM with respect to chemical and biological weapons. What they essentially said was, everything that they've got any records of or any documentation of, we checked out, and it's like they say. There are some instances wherein they say they destroyed this or they didn't make that, and they don't have records to that effect. And so we're continuing to look into this, you know, to see if we can figure out, well,
yeah.
There's no documentation, so how uh-huh. do we know for sure what happened? Okay.
That's
why Scott Ritter could say that they were 97% or 98% certain that there were no weapons, there were no chemical or biological programs, and al-Baradei was able to say, we're 100% certain there ain't nothing of a nuclear nature. Now, this was in 1997.
Yeah.
Okay. Clinton, and so the Russians and the Chinese wanted to remove the sanctions, which had been imposed because of the discovery of these programs. That's when Clinton publicly said, and upon entering as Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright said some of the same things, and there are quotes around. I don't have them right here, but I've cited them in some columns. And what the gist of it was, we don't care whether or not they've got nuclear weapons of mass destruction programs or not. We are not going to allow the sanctions to be removed until as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. Platt said that
yeah.
to the Security Council.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened then? Well, there were a couple of things that happened after that. Clinton, who's certainly not a neo-crazy, in Christmas of 98.
Well, now, wait a second, Gordon. Just to put this in a little bit more context, I think that there was a series of precedents that in part emerged out of the Yugoslav experience where Clinton and the people around him realized, if we act unilaterally, we have an option of beating up on people that we don't like.
nuclear weapons aren't involved in Kosovo and all that sort of thing, and so I know almost nothing about it. I defer to, you know, But I do know, and I have talked to Eagleburger, and I know he was insistent at the time, says, hey, you don't want to get involved in that mess.
Yeah.
I was an ambassador to that part of the world. Stay out of it. It's, you know, but nobody paid any attention to
him. Yeah, and Scowcroft, too, you know.
Huh?
Scowcroft also had experience in Yugoslavia.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
I think he was military attaché at the embassy there.
Is that right? Well, in any case, that didn't involve nuclear weapons, and so I don't know much about that. But I do know that in Christmas of 98, and Clinton was having his Monica problems at the time, he told the IAEA and UNSCOM to get out of the way because he had intelligence that there were nuclear weapons hidden under Saddam's policies.
Yeah.
And so he was going to clean them out. And I'm sure the reason he said they were under Saddam's policies are two reasons. One, that's the only place in Iraq that the IAEA hadn't been.
Well, when you say palaces, sometimes people, I almost never explain things for the audience, but in this case, I will, because it's a bit of an ambiguous term. Palaces in the Saddam era of Iraq meant complexes that were several square miles, perhaps, in size. I mean, a lot of them. So it's more of, you know, think of like an army base in the States or something.
Yeah, well, in any case, he said that I've got intelligence that there are nuclear weapons under there,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I'm going to attack them.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. 6 days, I think, something like that, cruise missiles, bunker busters, and everything else like that. And as we found out after the war, which was, 5 years later, there weren't any there, never had been. So that was a put-up deal, and the rationale, again, was that, well, maybe the IAEA is not incompetent, but at least their assurances that there are no nuclear weapons in Iraq don't cut any ice with me if I've got some other agenda. And so that, you know, you can't blame all this on Bush. It goes back to Madeleine Albright
right,
and to Clinton.
Right. That's an important point. Yeah, it does.
And of course, then ever after that, they continued these no-fly zones, trying to provoke Saddam into doing something or other that would give them an excuse to invade. And so, I don't know.
Well, now in line with this increased American unilateralism, which doesn't seem to have any kind of a logical termination to it, let me make this my last question, I guess. How might the world or the American electorate or somebody begin to reestablish some sort of constraints on that unilateralism? What kind of checks and balances in the world system might be possible or practical at this point?
I don't know the answer to that, and it's, as I say, it's not my field. I do know from what I've read that this is very, very of much concern to the Russians. And if it's of concern to the Russians, it ought to be of concern to us, because except for terrorists with box cutters, the only thing we really have to worry about in the world are what the Russians do with the 10,000 or so nuclear weapons they've still got on ICBMs, and they're still developing ICBMs. I don't know whether they're developing new nuclear weapons or not, but they're certainly making sure that they have got a deterrent.
Yeah.
Even though they're only a third the size in population, I don't know how much bigger they are in geographic area, but you know, they're not to be trifled with, or at least they're not to be treated the way that this administration seems to be treating them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, not everybody thinks the way we do, as we just discovered in North Korea. I don't know why they did that,
mm-hmm.
why they essentially wasted. You know, if you're going to test a nuclear weapon, there are two things that can happen. You can succeed or you can fail. And the consequences of failure seem to me to be more important even than the consequences of success in this case. So I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it must have occurred to somebody. in the Bush White House that they've now used up, assuming that the Bush administration understands that their claims about there being a uranium nuclear weapons program in Iraq, I'm sorry, in North Korea are unfounded, that there's no basis whatsoever for those claims, then all they've got to worry about is the, at max, 10 nuclear weapons, or the material to make 10 plutonium bombs that North Korea now has. And it, and the number is probably more like 6.
Right.
Because those upper limits are based upon being able, you know, to have a Los Alamos National Laboratory to do all this design and test work for you.
Under ideal circumstances and all that. Yeah.
And the evidence so far is they don't have anything like that.
Well, my sense of it is probably that we will discover that there's a regional version of mutual assured destruction that will evolve. And actually, in a way, maybe the North Koreans having exploded this device will have kind of a positive therapeutic effect on their policies and bring us back to discussions. At least that's what I hope.
I wish I could share your optimism as it is. What I see, and I'm writing a column right now, is Condi Rice and the rest of them immediately jumped upon this as a justification for imposing really onerous sanctions on Iran. This Proliferation Security Initiative, according to what I read, and all I know is what I read, we are presently, starting on October the 31st, going to conduct an exercise in the Persian Gulf.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Practicing stopping ships on the high seas and examining them for things that George Bush doesn't like. And at the top of that list is anything that's associated with a missile.
Missiles, yeah.
I'm not a missile guy, but it seems to me that missiles have played far, far too much a role from the very beginning, for going all the way back to the Nunn-Lugar original act. The original act didn't have ballistic missiles as being a weapon of mass destruction, and there's no conceivable way that a ballistic missile could be a weapon of mass destruction. Nevertheless, from 92 onward, the Pentagon and everybody else in the world has lumped that in. And I think it's probably because in the first Gulf War, well, go back a little further, the Iran-Iraq War, several hundred ballistic missiles were launched against, you know, more than 100 by the Iraqis against the Iranians and more than 100 by the Iranians against the Iraqis. You don't hear much about that.
Right.
Most of these were Scuds. That's a Russian World War II almost era missile, liquid fuel. You got to, you know, it takes hours to get the damn thing ready for launch. And the Koreans were helping at the end of the war. The Koreans were helping, this is the Iran-Iraq War, the North Koreans were helping the Iranians extend the range of their missiles.
Basically tying the missiles together to extend the...
I think so. But again, that's still ancient technology, liquid-fuel rockets.
Now, just a news item today, the South Koreans said that they have developed their own cruise missiles.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I figure if the South Koreans have cruise missiles, well, then the North Koreans are going to want them too. And the thing about cruise missiles that is kind of unique in a way is that if those proliferate, quite apart from whether they have nuclear payloads, they can get around most people's defenses. So it's a weapon that kind of gets out of control in a way.
Well, all those years ago when I was a naval officer, one of the things that I participated in was an operational test of a Regulus cruise missile that, armed with a nuclear weapon, we substituted an inert sphere for the core and the weapon, but it was otherwise, it was a real, honest-to-God nuclear weapon.
Mm.
And that was long ago. Let's see. Now, what I was going to say, the trouble with cruise missiles, or the danger of cruise missiles, at least as far as we're concerned, is because we depend so much on the U.S. Navy for power projection.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. what the British found out in the Falklands War, which is what now, over 20 years ago,
right,
is those ships are extremely vulnerable to cruise missiles.
Well, they were
even the old
Exocets, yeah.
Which was, I think it homed in on radar. I'm not exactly sure, but it was one of the very early French cruise missiles, which was carried by aircraft. It was that small. And they almost lost the Falklands War over that. The Chinese have upgraded a Russian cruise missile, an anti-ship missile.
Mm-hmm.
And the Iranians are alleged to have more than a few of those.
The silkworms, I think they're called.
Yeah, I think that a sunburst, maybe.
I think that's another one. I'm not sure which is the more recent. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. First is more recent. I think that's the upgraded one, but maybe you're right. Maybe it is silkworm. But in any case, okay, so here we got, starting October 31st, we're going to have this big exercise involving U.S. and some other ships, including one Canadian ship that I know of.
Huh.
And they're going to be in that enclosed thing, the Persian Gulf,
yeah,
where you can... I've never been there, but I'm told that at the Straits of Hormuz, you can look across and see the other side. You know, it's that constrained at the opening,
yeah,
of the Gulf. And here the Iranians are with all of these speedboat mounted or patrol boat mounted anti-ship missiles. And as they learned in the Falklands, one of those things. If your ship's got aluminum superstructure, it can set it on fire. Aluminum will burn.
Right, right.
Oh, Jesus. And that's, what's that, next week? When's the 31st?
Next week, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So here we are conducting this provocative exercise in the Persian Gulf.
You know, some time back I talked with the retired general, Lieutenant General Van Riper, who was most famous or notorious for playing the red team in a Gulf exercise where, as the opponent, he had managed in the first couple days of the exercise to sink the American fleet. It was a huge exercise, a Millennium 2000 or something, a $250 million exercise.
Wow.
And... and then they after he had sort of won the game, they didn't restart it in the normal way. They kept putting increasing restrictions on him. So finally, he just sort of sat out the remainder of the play. But the point being that a war against a literal state in the Gulf would not be an easy thing.
I think I read something about that. He's a Marine, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and what he did is he used small boats with anti-ship missiles.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's the way he did it. I encourage you, just privately, to take a look, to read this resolution, 1706, I think it is, the North Korean resolution,
mm-hmm.
paying particular attention to the part that I would call the PSI enabling legislation. That's the part where it says they're going to form a committee within the U.S. You know, it's a committee that's going to be composed of U.N. Security Council members, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That are going to make all these kind of things, calls upon members and to do all these kind of things. But the thing I think is critical about this is... This is not a council thing, so there ain't nobody got a veto in it.
Yeah.
And so if the Russians, for example, don't join up in this little committee they're setting up, then they'll have no say. Even if they do join up, they can't stop it. They can't veto it.
So what you're saying is that the real problem that we ought to be thinking about is how to live nicely with the Russians and the Chinese. And instead of doing that, we're setting up all these instruments that we control unilaterally, and that we may wind up conflicting with their perceived national interests and get into a whole much worse kind of situation than anything that we've run into before.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that, George. I know from what I read by name, you know, the big difference I see between what Russian officials do and say and what American officials do and say is the Russians tell you who they are. You know, they don't say, well, this is background and you can't quote me. You know, you can't say who I am.
So
you don't know who the heck it is. The Russians, they want you to know who they are. And they say, well, something clearly, it's busted right now. The UN Security Council is busted. There's all this, you know, argument about, well, how come we've got countries that don't matter very much having veto authority, like France?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have countries like India even on the council.
Right.
You know, how can that be? Well, there are all these different proposals by Bush and other people on how to reform it. There are all these proposals about what to do about the non-proliferation treaty. Bush has essentially decided to ignore it so long as he can't get any. And, of course, there's no enforcement mechanism in the non-proliferation treaty anyway.
We're probably in violation ourselves with new bomb research, wouldn't you say? Or
I wouldn't say that, but I would say that we are in violation when we impose sanctions on Iran that prevent Russia and China from exercising the requirements laid on them by the non-proliferation treaty. We are required in under that treaty to facilitate the fullest possible transfer of nuclear technology, especially to the undeveloped world.
That's interesting.
And it's a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And here not only are we not doing it, we are prohibiting countries that are trying to do it. And those are specific instances that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Now, again, you know, this is not I'm not a diplomat, and all I'm trying to say is that since 1992, in my opinion, various people, not just the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, have used the nuclear weapons programs, the build-down of nuclear weapons program, the proliferation of nuclear weapons for their own purposes, and in the process have made the proliferation of nuclear weapons much more likely.
Yeah.
As I said, those are not exactly my words in that column because they were changed from the way I actually said it, but I have said in previous columns that if anybody in this world is responsible for North Korea having nuclear weapons now, it's George W. Bush.
Yeah, clearly, yeah. Huh.
If you want to name one person, because, you know, they wouldn't have them. Now, I don't think it's such a bad thing, and obviously the Bush administration doesn't think it's such a bad thing either, because they're using this whole thing mostly is an excuse to put the screws on Iran.
Although, you know, in a way, don't you think that Korea might be sort of like an outer ring of security for Iran?
No, I don't know. I don't know about that. Mm. Again, that's more your part of the world. All I know is that as it now stands, North Korea has some plutonium, and they obviously do not know at the moment how to make a nuclear weapon with that plutonium. And I also know that the IAEA is as certain as any body can be that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program.
Right.
Iran.
Right.
Iran.
Right. Right, right, right.
And yet, every time the president or the secretary of state, Condi Rice, starts off saying something, or Bolton, our ambassador to the UN, starts off saying something about Iran, in the first sentence they make the flat-out statement that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Then, for the rest of the time, they talk about its nuclear program. And what you're supposed to think is, this is the nuclear weapons program that I talked about in the first sentence.
Yeah.
And many of the things they say about Iran's nuclear program are true, but they're you know, that's a safeguarded IAEA safeguarded program, and until last summer, 2005, the Iranians were cooperating with the in terms of not only the additional protocol, but they had gone to extremes even beyond that required by the additional protocol. And the additional protocol mm-hmm. hadn't been ratified, so mm-hmm. they were doing this out of the goodness of their heart. Mm-hmm. It's very much like now, I think, what we now know happened in November and December of 2002. The minister, Bush was before the UN Security Council mm-hmm. demanding that these inspectors be allowed back in.
Into Iraq that time, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and of course yeah. that's another issue, and that the IAEA inspectors had continued to go in. It was only the UNSCOM inspectors, the chemical biological warfare ones that were shot through with CIA people and things like that,
right.
that Saddam didn't allow back in. But at any rate, at the time they were saying, they apparently thought, well, Saddam would never allow these inspectors back in. And at the time, there were all these diplomatic things going back through all these different channels saying, God, we'll do anything you ask. What? Just tell us.
Yeah.
And they say, nothing will satisfy us except regime change. Well, we're not going to do that. But, you know, they're on bended knee practically. Well, yeah. the Iranians yeah. are not on bended knee, but they're basically saying the same thing. We'll basically do anything you want.
Right.
But we're not giving up our rights.
Right. Well, the difference would be that now that the U.S. is stuck in Iraq and that the military is practically broken in Iraq and that nobody seems to have a clear idea of how to get out or whether even if we try to get out, we'll be able to do so in an orderly way. Given that I think almost impossible for the services to imagine what a major attack on Iran would look like, unless, of course, you decide that you want to kind of nuke them into submission, which would be a whole different thing. So, you know, it would be nice if we could rule out that incredible possibility, but I don't know. I just,
I guess I don't see a deliberate nuclear attack as being in the works by the United States. What I do see happening, though, is whatever they call the fleet that's in the Persian Gulf right now,
mm-hmm.
about the time that most of those ships are on the bottom or are headed towards the bottom, that panic will set in somewhere, and the only thing that they'll know to do will be to kill civilians in Iran, you know, because there won't be anything else by then.
Uh-huh.
You know,
huh.
What else is there? At least threaten that.
Well, when they look at the options for attacking targets in Iran, they have to go after a whole series of layered defenses and associated facilities. And so right away, if you're talking about a war plan, it's not just a few or even a few dozen targets, but it becomes hundreds.
I've seen the number 400 in this nut. I've appeared opposite him, a retired Air Force general named McNerney or something like that.
I know the name, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been opposite him on the front page, as a matter of fact, their big story or whatever the name of it was.
Uh-huh.
In any case, and I don't know who's paying his salary. He's retired now, but somebody's paying him boku bucks to say these kind of things, and he's the one that lists all these targets, and he's one of the foremost proponents of this surgical strike. But that'll all be over with, okay? That'll be the first thing. Then what will happen is then the Iranians will react, and the only thing I know they have to react with are these anti-ship missiles.
Right, close down the Gulf.
All these targets out there in the middle of the Persian Gulf.
Right. Yeah, big targets.
And they claim that their versions can evade radar blocking and all that other kind of stuff, and I don't know why doubt them. And we'll have another Falklands kind of thing where, you know, it really gets serious. And so what happens when when you've lost a carrier battle group or something in the Persian Gulf, or they can't get out, you know?
Yeah.
So that would be stage two, the attack on our fleet. And then what do you do? Well, we haven't got any ground forces. We've already taken out all the things we can take out with conventional weapons. There's nothing left to do except to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of the people who worked in the nuclear weapons program never envisioned that happening. And that's where we're headed, unless somebody does something. And I don't see, really, that the elections, even if there's a change in the regime, I don't see how that's going to affect things very much, because, as the Russians used to call it, the correlation of forces is such that it doesn't really matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans in charge. They've all got this same idea of imposing regime change on all these countries that we don't like the looks of.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and where I enter into it, Gordon Prather enters into it, is they have chosen the fallacious claims, in my opinion, and in the opinion of the IAEA inspectors, that they've got these uranium nuclear weapons programs that nobody knows where they are. That's the rationale they've been using now, going all the way back to 1998, when Clinton bombed Saddam's policies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it hasn't changed. Now, there were some of the neo-crazies were in power then. Well, and in particular, Richard Perle. When I worked for Bellman, Henry Bellman of Oklahoma, Perle was working for Scoop Jackson of Washington.
Right.
And I talked to him a number of times. I didn't actually meet him then, but I did later, because we were practically in next door offices in the Pentagon in 1981.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. But you make the point elsewhere that the neocons aren't purely a Republican phenomenon. That you have
most of them are not even Republicans. They were Democrats. They were Scoop Jackson Democrats.
Right, or Hillary would certainly be very much influenced by them.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, she's got, you know, she went to China once. I don't even think she was a senator yet. I think she was still just the president's wife.
Yeah.
And so what does she beat them about the head and shoulders on? Human rights, you know. You haven't got enough women in charge of this and that and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
As I say, they've seized on nuclear weapons. The false pretense of nuclear weapons programs, we know they were false in Iraq. The IAEA claims they're false in the case of Iran.
Yeah.
The fact that this weapon they just tested was in North Korea was a plutonium device suggests that there's no truth to the charge that they have a uranium enrichment bomb program. So, you know, it's 3 out of 3.
And the way you describe it, which I think is quite persuasive, there's no reason to expect to see any of those programs anywhere anytime soon. So, well, Gordon, I don't want to exhaust either of us. We've gone for what for me is now a record that will probably never be surpassed.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. So we have to think of the listeners too, who may have to take this in small portions as they listen to it.
Okay.
But listen, thanks very much for talking with me. I really appreciate your time, and I have the highest regard for what you're writing. I think you're doing great work there, and God bless you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in closing, I will say that if Craig Roberts disappears, or we start nuking Iran, that's the last column you'll see of me, because this recent act makes it clear that I would be an enemy of the state if I wrote anything more.
Well, maybe we'll all run into each other in one of these camps that they're building in Arkansas.
Okay, George. See you then.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you very much, Gordon. And thank you, listening out there, for having had the patience to make it through. I really hope you found Gordon's understanding of nuclear things helpful. I certainly did.
I'm not quite sure what's on the plate for next week, as I'm going to juggle a couple of shows already recorded. Also, if possible, I'm going to try to put together, on short notice, a post-election show of very quick conversations with half a dozen or so people who follow politics. At this stage, that's just an idea, though, so please don't hold me to it if it doesn't work out. Thanks very much to those who wrote to me last week, and also for all your suggestions for guests. I really do enjoy hearing from the audience, so please don't hesitate to tell me what's on your mind. Okay, that's it then for this week. Thank you very much for being here, and please stay tuned to Electric Politics.